Blog Talk Radio.
Again, hi, this is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, and it is Sunday the 14th. We're recording a day after our normal airing time, but this will be posted, so all of you who regularly download the show, welcome, and glad to have you aboard. Last week, I posted and had information from Colin Andrews. He was the guest, and a number of you listeners were interested in more information on exactly where Göbekli Tepe was and exactly where these megaliths were and what was the importance of the megaliths. So following his presentation, I have posted some very early photographs of the T-shaped 40 to 60 ton megaliths that are in Göbekli Tepe. And one of real interest is a picture of Andrew actually standing on top of one of these huge stones that are about to be lifted off of the local quarry, these T-shaped stones that are just close by about 10 miles. And you can see exactly what he is describing in these unusual animals and what is now considered an observatory, or one of two observatories in the main civic area of Göbekli Tepe. So the title of that is, it's actually called Program Notes from Andrew Collins' Interview, and it's along with his actual audio so that you can listen to the whole thing. I also want to announce that I am going to be launching a website, a specific website for Earth Ancients that has my articles, my notes, and quite a bit of information from the various authors that I feature on the program. And when I announce it, I'll post it not only on Facebook, but I'm going to try to get the information sent out via all the social media channels and all the affiliates that we have that join us each week. Part of the program will also, or the announcement will also feature my new ebook, which is called The Black Knight, Ancient Satellite from Earth's Forgotten Past. And I am going to make the introduction and the first chapter available for free as a download. And I'll describe more of that in the coming weeks when it's made available. But I hope you do have a chance to check that out. The Black Knight's been it's been on people's minds off and on for probably over 5 or 6 years, maybe even longer. So this is my book, my research, and I think you'll find it interesting. Also, another area on the Facebook page is the location of Mayapan, Yucatan, which is a pretty old Mayan city in northern Yucatan, just above Mérida. And it's another series of photos from the Linda Shealy collection. And the thing that's pretty unique about most of her work is that the photographs were taken in the late 70s, early 80s, when many of these ruins were partially excavated. And the title of this is Mayapan, Yucatan, Mexico. And the focal point is the central pyramid. And the central pyramid is a multi-step smaller pyramid. But the great fun in this series of photographs is that she has shot a photograph of the pyramid itself before it was excavated. And you can see the growth of the rocks that are pushed around. And the odd shape of the pyramid, as if some powerful force, my thought is that it was probably water. It was underwater at some point, or it was pushed around by water. That entire area of northern Yucatan, if you go to the ruins, Sayil, Mayapan, Uxmal, Labna, those, before they excavated them, most of those buildings were covered under rock, under great amounts of dirt and debris, and there's no explanation for that. And so when you see these photographs that Linda Shealy has taken, and Linda Shealy is a well-known Mayanist, she's an archaeologist who passed away in the late 1980s, you can see her focus, her interest in just how these buildings were built, and she takes it a step further. She actually looks at the design, and the photographs are more of a reference for her than published for the general public. But to look at these pyramids that she's taken a photograph of, this main pyramid, is fascinating, and I really encourage you to take a look at that too. So it's it was posted a couple of days ago. It's called Mayapan, Yucatan, Mexico on the Earth Ancients Facebook page. Pyramids are in the news, and they're constantly in the news, and I've been fascinated by ancient Egypt for 20 years, or not, if not more. We've had Robert Schock talking about the Sphinx, John Anthony West, who's spoken about the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure, and a number of other authors who have talked to all of us about the technology, which they believe was a part of some of the construction of these buildings. But my guest today has written a book called Ancient Egypt, 39,000 BCE, The History, Technology, and Philosophy of Civilization X. And he actually takes a pretty bird's-eye view of not only the construction, but the way things were laid out. He has given us some insight into what he calls Civilization X. And I'm fascinated to learn more about that. My guest today is Edward Malkowski. He is the author of Before the Pharaohs, The Spiritual Technology of Ancient Egypt, and Sons of God, Daughters of Men. He's a historical researcher, and he lives in Lincoln, Illinois. Hi, Ed, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks, Cliff, for having me on.
Oh, it's really a pleasure. I'm curious, and I mean, we can talk about Civilization X here in a minute, but what is your interest, or what was your interest in writing this great book? And by the way, I really like all your photographs. You have some wonderful photographs in the book. But
thank you.
What really sparked your interest to take on the challenge of writing? Because it's a lot of work to write. It really is.
Well, it's I'm a born writer. I really didn't know that I was a writer for quite some time. But in high school, we all take those aptitude tests, and I took one my junior year, and it came back that I would excel in the literary arts. Well, at the time, I really wasn't thrilled with that, because I wanted to have a job. I wanted to go to college and get a degree where, you know, I could start making money and living right away. But with the people I work for, the corporations I work for, I always gravitated towards writing. Initially, I was a financial analyst, a business analyst, and then became a software developer. But I always gravitate toward writing things, like writing video reviews for the company paper and small articles. And I've always been a lover of history. This is from my very beginning in grade school. I was kind of fascinated a little bit with the Second World War and the history that brought life to me. I was born in 1961 and grew up in the 60s and 70s. So the 60s, a lot of that time was kind of the heyday, the golden age of a great generation that won the Second World War. MTV and magazines and periodicals, films was kind of about that. So my history started there. And blossomed into U.S. history in junior high, but specifically the Civil War. But then in college, it got a little broader. I took a world civilization class, and it was very not very informative about our beginnings. You know, it's the standard history
right.
that the pyramids were tombs. And nothing, you know, nothing technical or nothing really civilized existed before 3000 BC. So, it's, you know, they really shorthanded that part of history and just got on with, you know, Western history as we all studied it today. But then some 15 years later, in 1993, I watched John Anthony West and Robert Schock's The Mystery of the Sphinx. And The show was so compelling and so fantastically done that it kind of blew me away. So there in the mid-90s, I started, you know, I was kind of fed up with religion, fed up with academia. And I said, well, I'm going to get my own answers, you know. And the starting place really was Egypt, because Egypt was a 3,000-year-old civilization. And no civilization has ever come close to lasting that long ever since. So that's how I got into it. I decided to get my own answers and actually go to Egypt myself and see what was there.
Right. You know, one of the things that I find interesting is you described this Civilization X as a culture who worked in granite or worked in stone. And what did you find was unique about this? Would you say they're pre-dynastic? Obviously, they have to be. But were they? Did you find that they were part of the dynastic group? And they were technologists. It seems like. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. To answer that question really simply, there's two kinds of structures that you see in ancient Egypt. And those two kinds of structures are structures that are made of very hard stone. And are very large, they're megalithic. And then there's shabbier constructions where structures and pyramids are more of in a total state of ruins, as opposed to being, you know, perfectly standing. So what you see in ancient Egypt is you see an older culture that was very skilled with a good technology on how to build, and what they built lasted for many, many thousands of years. And then you see a younger culture, which is actually the dynastic culture, that came in afterwards, settled the same area, and built according to their own civilization. But their methods of construction and the materials they used was not the same as the megalithic stone builders. They used mud brick. They used simple stuff that we still use today. So stuff they built doesn't look nearly as good as the old stuff. That's the main feature I saw. And what I saw there that really, really made me start thinking even more is that wherever you went, no matter what site you went to, whether it was Giza or Abu Ghraib or Saqqara or Meidum or Abu Sur, Abu Ghraib, all these sites are littered with granite and granite debris. And you never see that on TV, but there's granite rubble everywhere.
When you don't see it on TV, do you think that's because they don't want to look at it because it's so messy, or does it just cause too many questions?
Well, I think you answered your own question right there. On the one hand, it's not really fun to look at because it's just, you know, large boulders of granite just piled everywhere and laying on the sand. On the other hand, the people that produce television shows, documentaries mainly, like History Channel, Discovery, and all that, they have an agenda, okay? And they want to put in that show the message that they want to put forward and entertain you with. So, you know, from an academic standpoint, the traditional Egyptologists, they have their own chronology of Egypt, their own history of Egypt, and they're not going to put on any documentary stuff that'll make people think, hey, what's going on here? What's all this granite rubble? You know, they don't want to give any clues to make people think further. They want people to believe their agenda and their dogma.
Right. You know, it's interesting because most of the major television shows are on the Giza Plateau. And that's the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid and the surrounding buildings. Now, we've already talked to Robert Schock and Anthony West about those areas. But in your book, you describe two cities that you've just mentioned, Abu Sir and Abu Ghraib, in depth. And there's quite a bit of stone masonry there of humongous portions. Can you describe that city, those two cities, a little bit better for us and tell us what you've discovered?
Yes. Abu Sir is actually a beautiful place to go. So if you ever go to Egypt, Abu Sir and Abu Ghraib are not really on the tourist map. They are, but they aren't. Typically, people don't go there. But if you have a driver, you can pay him whatever, you know, $20 or so, and he'll take you wherever you want to go. So definitely go to Abu Sir. Abu Sir is right on the edge of the Sahara, where it meets the fertile green areas that run along the Nile. And Abu Sir is actually on a hill. And when you step out of your car and go to it, it's just up on a great big sand hill, and there is a water trough that leads from the bottom of the hill all the way up the hill, and it's about 100 yards or so walking up this hill. And once you reach that, then you can see the temple area. And it's really almost intact. And what I mean by intact is a lot of stuff has not been taken away. Yes, the site is in ruins. The columns and the pillars have been knocked over and everything, but nothing's really been taken away. And so when you're standing on this, when you reach the top and you're standing on this black basalt patio, there's large megalithic granite columns that are all knocked over, that are broken. There's huge, long limestone blocks that have hieroglyphs carved into it. When you look around, the granite is sparkling in the sunshine, and you get a sense that you can feel the energy of the people that actually built that place. It's wonderful. Now, what's really cool is when you walk through the temple and you go to the back area, which is where the pit is, there's actually two granite boxes there. One's a large one, approximately 10 feet long, and another is a smaller one that's roughly 6 or 7 feet long. But these are two standard, perfectly made, as if they're manufactured from a factory, granite boxes that have the curved lid, and they're there in situ. And to see that beautiful pink granite shine in the sun and sparkle in the sun, and to actually look at, there's no markings on it at all. It's perfectly done. It's absolutely, absolutely amazing. And then about a quarter mile away, you can actually see Abu Ghraib from Abu Sir. Is Abu Ghraib. And what's really unique about it is it was some sort of water facility. Exactly what they were doing with the water is conjecture at this point. But there's dozens of water basins around, and there's more troughs leading out of Abu Ghraib. But what's weird about Abu Ghraib is there's this huge 15-foot diameter crystal table. I want to call it a table, and you can call it an altar. It's actually a platform. And it is just, it's a total mystery as to what it is. But both the sites are absolutely gorgeous. They're almost intact, and it's really wonderful to go there.
You describe a lot of what appears to be machining of these stones. Why do you think they're machined? What's the giveaway for them to be machined with some form of power tool?
Sure. Everyone who's taken a shop class, whether it's machine shop or whether it's wood shop, everyone knows, and the handyman's know this in particular, is every tool leaves a mark. If you cut something, it's going to leave a mark. If you use a chisel, it leaves one kind of mark. If you use a handsaw, it leaves another kind of mark. If you use a circular saw, it leaves another kind of mark, and so on. And we know that, you know, certain tools leave these certain marks. So when you start looking very, very closely at some of these stones that are actually out in the open, on the Giza Plateau, excuse me, on the north side of the plateau, there's a black basalt patio of the Great Pyramid. And if you start looking at the edges of this patio, which is no longer the true edges, the patio was actually much larger, and a number of stones had been removed around the perimeter and taken away to be used by, you know, people much, much later. Well, this exposed some of the inner stones that had been placed. And if you start looking closely at them, you can see very obviously that there's very, very tiny, small markings on them that have a distinct pattern to them. And the pattern is linear, and it's even. And it's almost microscopic, but not quite. You can see with your naked eye, but you got to look close. Well, the only way to make those marks, and I've talked to machinists about this, and I know Christopher Dunn, he's an expert in that area. Machines leave these marks. Hand tools don't leave these marks. And to be more specific, if you go to a place called Abu Rawash, which is about 5 miles to the north of Giza, there's a large stone there that is in pristine condition because it was left. Abu Rawash wasn't really excavated until the mid-90s. So when they excavated Abu Rawash, they were uncovering stuff that had never been seen before. And they uncovered this stone, and they pulled it out, and they placed it upon six softball-sized rocks. You can plainly see it's a large stone. It's 3.5 feet long by about 3 feet wide, about 1.5 feet thick. You can see very obviously looking at it that it was a broken off piece of stone that broke off when it was being cut by a circular saw, because the pattern, the markings from the tool there on the stone are in a perfect striation pattern, just like you would cut a piece of wood and you'd see the circular markings of the saw on the wood. It's the same thing. There's really no argument about it. Those marks have to be made by those types of tools.
You actually call that in your book. You say it's the, I think you term it the new Rosetta Stone, and for the reason you describe it, it is plain to see that it was cut using saws of some nature. Now you say.
I take it a step further. In the book, my wife and I were walking through Menards in Champaign, Illinois. This is when I lived in Champaign. And they had tiles. They had a whole tile of and a whole aisle of tiles. And I stopped and looked, and I saw the granite section. So I went, and these are 1 foot square tiles. So I went and grabbed the tile, and I turned it around. And it had the exact same markings that the stone at Abu Rawash had. So there's actually a picture in the book. On the left, you have the markings, the stone from at Abu Rawash. And then right next to it, you have a stone, you know, cuttings on a stone that I purchased at Menards. So when you look at both stones, they look pretty much the same, except one's pink and one's gray.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's very obvious.
Hmm. And I'm looking at the photo in the book. It's actually also concave, like they cut the middle out, or they made it curved somehow. It's like I've never seen it before. It's amazing. It's a piece of stone. It's a solid piece of granite that's been cut in such a way that it is it has a curve to the middle of it. I don't know how they did that.
That Christopher Dunn understands how that was done, and he actually explained it in an article a number of years ago in Atlantis Rising. It's a machinist trick. If you have an object that you need to cut, but the object that you want to cut is actually larger than the circular saw you have, you can tilt that saw as you're cutting, and that will accomplish, the finished pieces you want. However, the waste piece, what's left over from that type of cut, is going to have a concave feature to its structure.
Concave is the word, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And what kind of saws must have been used to cut granite? It must be a really, really, diamond tip saw, or some kind of a saw that is really, really sharp.
Yeah, it would. Well, this has been known for a very long time. I mean, even if you go back to William Flinders Petrie, who is kind of the father of modern archaeology. When he wrote his book, the Pyramids of Giza, he even noted in it that to make these cuts, you'd have to have jewel tip saws. So this is going back to the 1880s, 1900. Mm-hmm. This is 120 years ago that human people, alive in the modern era, understood that to make those cuts in Egypt, you had to have jewel tip saws.
Yeah, but I mean, it throws history all out of whack when we start talking about power saws that are turning at terrific speeds to cut granite. So, in Chris's book, Chris Dunn's book, Giza Power Plant, he describes the Great Pyramid as some form of a power plant that may have powered things. But, I mean, what do you say on that? Because there must have been something going on there to be able to cut solid granite rock.
Right. Right. Well, the factual answer to your question is the energy that they were using is still a mystery. Okay, so it's still speculation. However, based upon what we know about the ancient Egyptians, and here I'm talking about the Civilization X ancient Egyptians, is that they had an understanding of physics, an understanding of nature that was a different perception than ours. And the best clue that we have is the actual Great Pyramid itself. A number of people, experts in sound and acoustics, have been at the Great Pyramid, and even the modern Egyptologists understand that the Great Pyramid, it was built with a resonance and sound in mind, because the upper chamber, what's called the King's Chamber, is total granite. The floor, ceiling, walls are all made of granite, and granite has a resonance to it that even people today understand. People who specialize in stereos, they know that using granite as a base to create your sound system is the best way to do it because of granite's resonance properties. So it seems apparent that the ancient Egyptians understood vibration, and they took a physics approach to power through sound, as opposed to electricity. How they produced that sound and how they turned that sound into something that could cut, that's a whole other physics that's beyond modern man.
So do you have a I mean, when you go, I have not been to the Giza Plateau, but would you say when you visit the Giza Plateau that you pick up a certain resonance, a certain energy, a certain unseen essence that may have been that is a part of that area? You know, maybe like as an example, we've learned in the last couple of years that the a number of the Mayan pyramids were built on geomagnetic fields. That when these fields went up and burst into up out of the ground, the pyramids were used as resonators to increase that energy. And there's some aspect of water too that we don't understand how the water conducts electricity, but they pass water through. As an example, the pyramid of the serpent in Mexico has a water channel that's cut into it that carried water in and out of the pyramid. We don't understand why, but I was curious as to what you may have picked up in terms of a unseen energetic field or sensations, or if you're sensitive, I don't know, but you know, just interested in what you might have picked up.
I am sensitive, and the most sensitivity I felt was really at Abu Ghosh as opposed to the Giza Plateau.
Huh.
That's where I felt the most energy. That's where I sensed the most connection to our ancient ancestors at Abu Ghosh. And why I think that is the case, I'm not saying none of that exists at Giza, but Giza is highly commercialized. Giza Plateau is a money machine.
Right.
There's hundreds of people hawking trinkets and cokes and different items. There's all kinds of tourists. There's vehicles all over. But what's unique about the Giza Plateau, and this is actually the core of the paradigm shift that's going on, that actually started with ancient Egypt, looking into ancient Egypt about 20 years ago, is that if it wasn't for the Great Pyramid, I wouldn't be researching anything. There'd be really no reason to research anything. The Great Pyramid is exceptional, not just because of its size, but because it has three inner chambers and a half a dozen or so passages inside it. So when they built the Great Pyramid, they actually had to plan to build for these rooms as they were laying each course of stone. It's a very complicated construction project, and these people did it. So as far as vibrations go, I got some serious vibrations inside the Great Pyramid, because once you go in there...
Oh, really?
Yeah, once you go in there, then the commercialized area outside is kind of blocked out, and you're crawling through these passageways, you know, going to the Queen's Chamber, going into the Grand Gallery, and then going into the King's Chamber. And once you get into the King's Chamber, it's just completely granite. Everything around you is granite. And the sensations in there are they're hard to explain, but it's beautiful.
Your chapter 6, the title is A Pyramid of Assumptions. And you kind of go into discussing maybe the philosophy of pyramids, that they're not tombs, that there may be something else. Can you give us a little highlight about that, what you think pyramids were for, and maybe how they were utilized?
Sure. Obviously, the pyramids weren't tombs. And why the earliest Egyptologists assumed they were tombs is that on the west and east side of the Giza Plateau there's actual cemeteries there now, but these cemeteries are actually very old cemeteries. They're from the early dynastic period. We're here. We're talking 2000 BC to 3000 BC. So it seems to me that the dynastic Egyptians, when they arrived and started to, you know, form their civilization in 3000 BC, it seems to me that they didn't know what they were. And they kind of sort of assumed they were tombs. And that actually carried forward to modern times in the 19th century when the Egyptology, you know, put that stamp on it, you know, the pyramids are tombs. But it's very clear that they're not tombs, especially with the Great Pyramid. If you look at the Great Pyramid, if you look at a cross section of it, it looks like some kind of device, some kind of machine for doing something. That's what it appears to be. So that's how it all started. But what actually the pyramids are for, I have my own theory. And my own theory starts with the work of a guy by the name of John Cadman, who lives up in the state of Washington. He's an engineer. He's a marine engineer. And he had got fascinated with Edward Kunkel's book, The Pharaoh's Water Pump. This is a book that was put out in the 1960s that the Great Pyramid was actually a water pump to move water.
Anyway, right.
Cadman had got the book and read the book and, you know, thought Kunkel was actually onto something. He wasn't totally correct, but he was onto something because the subterranean chamber of the Great Pyramid, which has been a mystery for the most part, it's just this great big chamber with these curvy stones in it. That really didn't make any sense. But John Cadman started looking at the subterranean chamber and started looking at the cross section of the Great Pyramid and saying, you know what? The subterranean chamber looks like it was a ram pump, a pump that uses its own energy to pump water as opposed to a pump that uses electricity. So Cadman went on and started making models. He got as many photos as he could. That's my cat. If you can hear that crying,
I hear him.
He started making models of the subterranean chamber and actually proved scientifically that the subterranean chamber was a water pump. So, looking at that, and then looking at what that pumping motion does, this is through Cadman's experiments. Through his models, is that pumping of water at the base of the Great Pyramid actually created a pressure wave, a vibration that moves straight upwards, okay?
So into the top of the pyramid or into upper chambers or where?
In moving up through the pyramid, going straight up to the pyramid to the king's chamber, okay? So now we have a piece of science here that we can use to try and figure out what they were doing. All right? So we know that granite has very high resonant properties, and the top chamber in the pyramid is all made of granite. And we have a water pump at the base of the pyramid that is creating a vertical compression wave, a vibration, a sound wave that's moving through the pyramid. So obviously they're vibrating the king's chamber. Okay, well, what's the king's chamber going to do when it vibrates? Well, this we don't really know, because in order to know that, we'd have to make a model of it and actually try it out. But just to look at the physics of it, if you have that sound vibration moving up to the top chamber, and there's two shafts in the king's chamber, one to the north, one to the south, if you have that granite resonating, okay, and the vibrations collecting and resonating in the king's chamber, then they're going to be moving out the north shaft and the south shaft into the atmosphere around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's that going to do? There's very little research on this. Excuse me. But research does exist. Russian scientists back 10, 20 years ago were looking on how they could modify the weather, the atmosphere, by using pressure waves that they're termed for sound. You know, it's almost along the same lines of, what's that thing up in Alaska?
Harp array, they call it.
Yeah, it's kind of the same general style. It's what? How can we modify the atmosphere? Anyway, these Russian scientists found out that by putting sound into the atmosphere, they can actually ionize the atmosphere. Okay. So then the next step is, well, why would you want to do that? Well, this bubble of ionized atmosphere around the pyramid system, what it does is create a bubble. It's actually kind of a field. It's actually kind of a radiation field. Okay, it's not radiation that hurts you or kills you or anything like that. It's just there's this bubble of energy, a force field, if you will, that's around you. You can't see it, can't feel it. It's not going to harm you or nothing. But what it does, okay, is it will deflect very low frequencies that exist naturally in the atmosphere because of thunderstorms around the world. It will focus those energies to the ground. Okay, so and then there's 10 pyramids in a row going from north to south, and as each pyramid, as you move south, each pyramid gets a little bit shorter. So my idea was that they're using the Great Pyramid as an engine to create this ionized field to redirect very low frequencies and extremely low frequencies in the air into the fields. Well, why would they do that is studies show today, and this is modern science, that if you expose crops and seeds to slow-moving electrons, it actually acts like an inoculation to those seeds and to those plants. They grow better, they grow faster, and they're more healthy, and they have a higher yield. So, to me, this makes absolute total sense. And it does so because I am an economist at heart. That's where my formal training is.
I'm sorry, what's your formal training? I didn't hear that.
My formal training is as an economist. I have a business.
Oh, economist. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right.
Very good.
Right. You know, it's a serious question, and it's a serious a question about motivation. Is why would any people build these very large, very expensive structures? Okay, just to give you some numbers, a firm over in Europe did a cost analysis on what it would cost to build the Great Pyramid. Okay, using the exact materials today, it would cost $435 billion just for the Great Pyramid.
$1 billion.
Yes. Okay. Now, if we cheat a little bit and we can swap out some construction materials, you know, we could get that cost down to $35 billion for the Great Pyramid.
And why is it so expensive? Is it because of the granite?
The granite, the limestone, the actual cutting of the blocks, you know, if we swap out materials, we could do it a lot cheaper. But it'd still be $35 billion.
Jesus. Okay.
Right. So the point I'd like to make is looking at an overview of this civilization is they didn't just build one pyramid. They built 10, okay, all in a line, north and south by the Nile, on the west side of the Nile. So economics exists today just as it did 5,000, 20,000 years ago. It doesn't matter. When you build something, you have to use resources to construct that structure. You know, it doesn't construct itself. So the manpower, the energy, the food, the management, the planning that we use today to build something, they had to do it too.
Right.
So to get your people to do this for you, there has to be a very, very, very good reason why everyone would collaborate to do it. And to build a tomb for a vain king is not why they would do it. They would build these structures because these structures are so expensive, they would have to have some utilization for the people. All right? You know, that's what civilizations do. We do it today. We build large things because it's going to be good for all of us. The Hoover Dam is a really good example of it. You know, we built the Hoover Dam because, you know, a large number of people needed that water. Same idea. Okay? Well, after a disaster, which happened 12,000 years ago, we just call it the end of the Ice Age, but it's actually a global disaster. After that disaster, it would be necessary to ensure that you had food for your civilization to continue. That's the motivating factor behind the Great Pyramids, and I think what science there is actually backs that up.
You said 10 pyramids. Now, you're talking about 10 pyramids in a row. We know about the three in the Giza Plateau, and then there's the two that you mentioned. Let's see.
There's Giza, then there's Saqqara.
Saqqara, right.
Then there's Dahshur. Then there's Meidum. There's also Abu Rosh in the north. There's also Abu Sur and Abu Ghraib in there.
Well, Abu Sur, is it Abu Sur that has, it was deconstructed? Or is that the Abu Wash, the other one? Okay. So
well,
that's
Abu Rosh was never finished.
Okay. It seems like I always read that it was deconstructed. It was dismantled. A portion of it was dismantled. But if you think it was never completed, is that what they think? I hear different speculation about it, but it's a very unusual place.
Well, I was there. And, you know, I'm not an expert in construction, although it's I have been a handyman and I have had a shop and was a mechanic for a little while when I was a whole lot younger. But to me,
right.
It's very obvious. If you go to Abu Rawash, it's very obvious it was never completed. The descending passage was dug, and the pit was dug into the bedrock. This is going down about 300 feet, okay? And
yeah.
about five or six courses of the casing stones were put around the pyramid. But it's very obvious it just wasn't finished. And my own take on that is when they were building Abu Rawash, okay, and they're about a third of the way through it, they found a better spot 5 miles to the south, which is the Giza Plateau. Okay.
Huh.
Abu Rawash is up on this big bluff, this big cliff. It's about 500 feet above where the normal surface is. So there's definitely some natural energy there existing there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the Giza Plateau was just a much better spot for them to put their engine.
So you don't think that you think it was uncompleted because they didn't get the right vibration out of the system? Because I think someone talks about going down at the base of that pyramid and seeing what looks like burnt stone or charred stone, like it was a processing center or some kind of a center for generating something. We don't know. Did you go down
to
the bottom of that?
Yeah. I think what they were looking at, what they were seeing down there, I think what they were seeing is part of the process that builders were using as they were building. I don't think it was anything unique or special.
Okay.
It just didn't appear to me that way. And I'm not saying there was no – actually, there was good energy at Abu Rawash because I felt it. But the energy at Giza, originally was better. It's not that Abu Rawash, didn't have any. It's just that Giza was actually the perfect spot, and they didn't notice Giza until after they started Abu Rawash. So they changed plans and abandoned Abu Rawash and started, building on Giza.
It's interesting because I haven't heard anyone speak about unifying the pyramids, the 10 pyramids. And you're the first one who's really talked about it in any depth. What's your thinking on this resonation? I mean, in other words, if the main pyramid is pumping out this ionized air, what were the other pyramids involved in? Were they grounding the air, or did they have some kind of a inner works that were going on also?
Well, this is going to get to. I wish my youngest son was here. He's a physicist. He could say this a whole lot better.
Well, no, I mean, just
but I'm going to go ahead and give it a go. Okay, I'm going to start with lightning to explain this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Lightning occurs because there's a great difference between the charge at the ground and the charge in the sky. Okay?
Okay.
All right. As the atmosphere builds a thunderstorm, the atmosphere is actually ionized. And the greater disparity between the sky and the ground, from physics, this disparity has to be canceled out. So once a threshold is met in the sky of a disparity in charge, that charge must be done away with. Okay, so you get that charge moving to the ground as a bolt of lightning. Okay, that's the principle that I'm going to try and to describe here. Okay,
okay.
So the energy that was being created from the Great Pyramid, okay, the pyramids to the south are shorter, but they still have those resonant qualities, okay, that they're actually attracting the energy flow moving from the north to the south. So that's why you had the pyramids other than the engine. You had the Great Pyramid as the engine, and then the other pyramids, to the south as receivers, as relay stations, so to speak. Although relay stations is not the word I really want to use. I'm just trying to get across the principle that was being used. Okay. So they had one engine and they had nine pyramids, and this was a system to fertilize this large field. There's like 20 miles difference between Meidum and Giza. So they were fertilizing a 20-mile long by, 5-mile wide strip of land to where they were planting their crops.
Wow.
I know it's kind of boring.
Curious. The
pyramids were used that to fertilize food, to fertilize crops.
John Burke says the same thing in his book about the ancient domes and rock housings that were built by prehistoric people in America. He says that they just capture the energy because they put their seeds in there to fertilize, so they'll grow better and fertilize,
That's absolutely correct. That's correct.
So
John,
what you're saying is too far out.
Fantastic research. So, well, you see, you brought up John Burke's book, and I do reference his book in AD 39,000. Actually looking at, this is where I get excited, because now I can become philosophical, and I can start looking at history in a very long duration. Okay, so what we're looking at when we're looking at Stonehenge and these other places in Europe, even the Americas, that Burke is talking about, we are looking at knowledge that was passed down after the Great Cataclysm. So the survivors who survived the end of the Ice Age 12,000 years ago, they were using what knowledge they had to make life as good as possible. Okay. Now we see it as primitive because they were the survivors. They had to use what tools they had and get things done as they could. So nothing looks as great as the Giza Plateau, which was built by a large force of survivors that still had equipment. Okay. And Ground Zero was in North America, which is kind of far away from Egypt. So they survived in a better way, but it actually makes perfect sense if you look at it like that.
Where's Ground Zero in America?
12,000 years ago, our planet was hit by a radiation storm and then by asteroids and comets. What actually happened is a star in the Vela system, which is a nearby system, went type 2 supernova 12,000 years ago, and it blew a planetoid size ball of plasma into our solar system, and this is captured in the Greek myth of Phaeton and the Chariot of the Sun. Is also captured in the Egyptian myth, Hathor and the Eye of Ra. Anyway, this fireball of plasma came ricocheting through our solar system, and it had a close encounter with Earth. And ground zero that was facing this plasma going by us, ground zero was actually the Great Lakes area. That's where the intense heat and radiation. That's where the intense heat and radiation and actually was focused at. I mean, the entire planet was affected, obviously, but North America was actually ground zero. And this also makes historic sense because in North America, there's not really a lot of ancient stuff as there is on the other side of the planet. Plus, all of our animals went extinct. Other side of the planet didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was trying to figure out what you were talking about. I think there's the book that I reference quite a bit. It's The Cycles of Cosmic Catastrophes. And that's Firestone's West book.
Right.
Where he actually shows the bits of asteroid in the mammoth tusks and how it blew out the Carolina various lakes and things like that.
The Carolina Bays, I think they're called.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. What's your take on ancient Egypt? I mean, obviously, your book is well, I'll tell you what I want to ask you. Ancient Egypt, 39,000 BCE. Now, where does 39,000 come in? Because that's before the catastrophe.
Right.
We're still in the Ice Age at 39,000, aren't we?
Well, there was ice somewhere. You know, I'm not sure why we call it the Ice Age. I think we call it the Ice Age because the glaciers came down halfway through North America. It wasn't an Ice Age everywhere. The middle part of the planet was very fertile, and there was civilization there. It's history, to answer your question. It's what the ancient Egyptians, this is here I'm talking with the dynastic Egyptians, it's what they actually claim. There's two different sources for this. There's the Palermo Stone, and there's also the Turin Papyrus that really pretty much say the same thing. And it is an actual listing of the kingships. And what these two pieces of evidence say is that Manes started the first dynasty at 3000 BC. Okay, before him, the followers of Horus ruled for like 13,000 years. And before the followers of Horus ruled, the gods ruled Egypt for 23,000 years. I don't know if I have my numbers correct there. But anyway, it adds up to 39,000 BC is when, you know, the Egyptians say that their civilization began. That's where the
I get it. Because, in your book, you actually give the various pharaohs that lead into the pre-dynastic period. I gotcha. Okay.
Right.
I gotcha. Very good. Now it makes sense. Yeah. And it's funny because a lot of these individuals who are featured in there are there's no way for us to verify them other than at some point it's so far back they're considered gods.
That's what we think. Okay. Let's talk about God just for a little bit here.
Sure.
Because here we have problems with 5,000 year difference in time. We also have a problem with the actual concept of God. Okay. And it's really about a bad translation. The word God doesn't really exist in ancient Egypt. That's a modern creation that came out of Greece. Okay, they had an idea. There was a word called neter, which neter is actually a principle of nature. And in the context of the Greek language, they had to decide, the Greeks did, if they should use this word neter as a principle, as in nature, or as a deity, as in something to be worshipped. Okay, so, you know, it was a contextual matter where they, made that definition of the word God. Well, when the gods ruled, okay, I do not believe is referring to a deity, all right? I believe it is referring to the mode of that civilization, their modality, okay, that civilization was living totally in harmony on the principles of nature. That's my take on it. I think that makes a whole lot more sense than trying to force our religious ideas on something that existed many, 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 many thousands of years ago. I just don't think it works. I mean, some of these archaeologists, they find a bowl and they automatically think there's some religious significance to it, when actually it was Sweet Pea's water bowl and Sweet Pea was a dog. We got to start thinking outside the box a little bit and kind of start looking at things in a more functional way of looking at them, as opposed to trying to force our modern beliefs on something that existed thousands of years ago.
Well, that's an important part, but I have to ask you, I have a personal interest in ancient known and unknown civilizations, because I think that our history has it wrong, and it has been editing along the way when a concept or a discovery doesn't fit. So my question to you, Ed, is what's your take? What's your interest in ancient unknown history? But more to the point, I have 150,000 people reading Earth Ancients from around the world who are eating this up and wanting more information. Why is there such an interest in it? Is it because we've been told the wrong story? Or is it an innate desire to know where the Earth has been?
God, I love this topic. This is my favorite topic. Okay? It's all of that. Okay? But it's actually more. I truly am convinced that, you know how there's 95% of our DNA is junk DNA and it's not really used for anything? Okay? Well, obviously that junk DNA is not junk DNA. That's just a bad word to use. That's why the science press termed it like that, I don't know. But obviously all of our DNA is important. All right? We wouldn't exist without it. Well, I do believe, and I think the evidence is really, really starting to get there, and this is starting to become actual science. It's called epigenetics. Okay, scientists are actually starting to look at memory being part of DNA. All right. So my hypothesis is that why the world is waking up now, why there's this paradigm shift going on, which actually started with the hippies. It didn't start 20 years ago with John Anthony West and the Mystery of the Sphinx, okay, and Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods. I mean, that's where it actually came to a head and came to something we can hold on to. But it actually started back in the 60s with the countercultural revolution of the hippies. You know, peace and love. We want peace and love is what we want. Well, anyway, getting back to the memory, our DNA contains all of our memories. It's just that they're untapped. Okay? So as long as the human species has existed, our entire memory is encapsulated in our DNA, which we pass on every single generation. This is what a baby is. Get half your DNA from your mom, half your DNA from your dad. This has been going on for a very, 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 very long time. So, you know, we can understand why 95% of DNA is junk, because it's memory that's been building up for such a long time. Anyway, we are getting to the state, we the people are getting to the state where our knowledge base in our own heads has grown to the point that it's starting to access that hidden away DNA. So everyone all over the world is excited about this, because when they hear the truth about their history, their own bodies, their own souls resonates with that truth. This is why everyone's excited about it.
So when they read something about a discovery that's unknown, or they read about, in your case, revelations in modern, what we would consider modern construction techniques used in ancient Egypt, it kind of triggers something, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Sure.
And it's an aha moment, but you want to know more because so basically you're saying there is, it's a multiple lifetime kind of a DNA. When you're born, you have these unused DNA, RNA, whatever, and as you tap, as you think, you access these resources, these mini computers of ancient past history, right? Is that what you're saying? So you believe in reincarnation?
Yeah, I do. I don't think there's any. I'm a philosopher and a historian at heart, and one of my biggest questions, this is throughout my entire life, even going back when I was a little boy, is why are people the way they are? Okay, people's characters are a continuum. On one end, you have basically the human animal. He really has very little conscience. All he wants to do is satisfy his own physical urges. You know, he wants to eat, drink, and have sex, and that's really pretty much all he thinks about. That's the lowest point of being. But you have a continuum of enlightenment beyond that basal state. You know, you have people who are more intellectual, more intelligent. You have people who then become a little bit more spiritual. They become religious, and then there's different gradients of that. And you have people who become enlightened, and there's different gradients of that. And you have above that, you have people who are becoming awakened. You know, if you start looking at history, you start seeing people like Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad. There's different people throughout our history. There's even modern people like that who are truly awakened spiritual people. So anyway, getting back to reincarnation, there's this whole continuum of people and different levels of knowledge of enlightenment. Why? Why does that exist? Why does our humanity exist in that manner? It's a very interesting thought. And the only way I can solve that is to accept the fact of reincarnation. Because if reincarnation is true, your first incarnation, you're not going to know what to do. You're going to exist pretty much as an animal. Okay? But as you reincarnate more, okay, the soul, your soul remembers and learns as it's here each time. So each time it incarnates, it grows and becomes more mature. So I don't know what the number is, if it's 10 times or 20 times or 1,000 times. At some point in time, you know, this soul is growing throughout its different lives and comes to a point where it's ready to be awakened and become essentially a god with a lowercase g.
Amazing. Appreciate that insight. So in our last couple of minutes here, what's your turn on for ancient history? Obviously, this book was a period of your life that you thought needed to be discerned and described, and then you wrote this book. But what do you find is something that we can take away from your current research and your understandings about ancient history?
What is truth? You know, it's why this happened to me so long ago, I really don't know. But each of us are on a spiritual path, and my spiritual path started when I was a young boy. You know, I want to know what truth was. What is truth? And then when you look at history, and here this is coming from a more Christian background because I grew up in a Christian home. I was raised Catholic, and my mom was Baptist, so I was very familiar with the Bible. And at that time, you know, I understood that there were different versions of history. You know, the Christians had their version of history. The scientists and the Darwinian evolutionists had their version of history. you know, and then there's all these different theories on different styles of history. Well, you know, if you put it all together, there's like, you know, 20 or 30 different versions of history. Well,
right.
There has to be one version that is the truth, that, you know, what actually happened. So my point of view, I wanted to know what really happened back then to make us who we are now. And in my most recent book, which is called Return of the Golden Age, I do believe, and I'm convinced that I have found that, why we are the way we are today, why we have the system and the society we have, where we have a few people at the top that own everything and everyone else works for them, goes back 12,000 years to a global cataclysm that almost destroyed our planet. And the survivors of that, they went from a paradise planet to a desolate planet. And they had to struggle and scratch and do whatever they could to survive. And they would build their own golden age by forcing other people or getting other people to work for them. So that's what motivates me.
A new paradigm was set up. Wow.
Correct.
The book is Ancient Egypt, 39,000 BCE, The History, Technology, and Philosophy of Civilization X. My guest today is Edward F. Malkowski, and I really appreciate your time today. Do you want to let us know where you're going to be? Do you have any new books, anything coming out the fall or early next year?
No, I don't have anything coming out. I just got done with doing three conferences this past year. And I am working on a new book. It's a little bit of a change. It will involve some ancient Egypt, but mostly it's going to be more about the paradigm shift that's going on right now. My working title, I'm calling it Perfect Symbolism, The Art of Being.
Fantastic. I love it. All right. Well, thanks. Appreciate your time. Really insightful work. And I'm going to go ahead and post some photographs from a couple of photographs from the book. And I think you can still get the book on, you can get it on Amazon. I just saw it there. So fantastic.
Right. You can get all my books on Amazon except for the first one that's out of print.
Okay. And do you have any place you're going to be speaking in the next week, month, or before the end of the year?
No, sir, I'm not.
Okay, good. Well, that means people can get the book.
Great. Yeah.
All right. Hey, thank you very much, and we appreciate your time. As a reminder, each week I do post photographs of our guests, and you can see these new photographs that I'll put up on our Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past Facebook page. We'll see you next time.